exciting presentation today by Professor David Ralston, which looks quite interesting. Before we get started, I'd like to make a couple of announcements. The first one is that our next Brown Bag presentation will be next Tuesday, October 17th. Ronald Freeman, who is a University of Michigan R.D. McKenzie Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Sociology and a Research Associate at the University of Michigan Population Studies Center, will be speaking on the topic, Does Taiwan's Very Low Fertility Mean a Declining Population Soon? Promises to be quite interesting. Also, the day after tomorrow, on Thursday, October 12th, at 12 noon, at the University of Michigan China Data Center, will be holding its Brown Bag Lecture Series in room 1644 of this building. Professor Changshen He of the Department of Geography at Western Michigan University will be presenting a talk on the drying of the Yellow River and lessons from the Colorado River. Today we have with us, again, David Ralston, who's an associate professor of Chinese languages and literature in the Department of Asian Languages and Cultures here.
Thank you. There's a handout, and it looks like this, and it'll be clear when the lights go off. And I don't expect you to be able to read that version, don't worry. But that's what it looks like, and it's over on the table. The title of the talk begins with a quote, "When are they going to stop screaming and start singing?" Which is something that I heard at this performance of Peking Opera in Detroit last year in the spring. The other half of my title is Westerners and Peking Opera. What I want to focus on is more what Westerners think of Peking Opera, or more precisely, what Westerners are thought to think of Peking Opera. This topic is important because Peking Opera troupes in China are now heavily reliant on ticket sales to foreigners. So how did Peking Opera get into such a fix? Here's a summary of the main points from a talk I gave here last year. Again, I don't expect you to read the detail, but just notice over here the number of items that are labeled decay versus the number of items that are labeled health. There's another sheet and the same basic conclusion. This is part of the handout that you had, Reasons for Decline of Qingzhu. Very quickly, in no particular order, the plays are hard to understand. They're spoken in a kind of dialect, hard to understand because people are less familiar with the material they're talking about. No good plays, no new ones, senior actors don't perform, no good finickings, faces too slow, too raucous, music primitive, got other things to do, folks want to stay at home, the Cultural Revolution screwed everything up, no real ritual or social function except to show to foreigners, and corners are being cut. So audiences for regular performances of Peking Opera have fallen drastically, so that the more you perform nowadays, the more money you lose. Those are regular performances. But what's turned things around, financially at least, was the establishment of a tourist theater where they show tourist opera. And this is their webpage, the Liyuan Theater, located in a fancy hotel. The Tourism Bureau invested 800,000 renminbi in 1990 in this project. This claims that they have famous actors, but it's not really true. They're unknown actors. There's stuff to eat and there's stuff to drink. The opening of this theater greatly changed the financial picture for Peking Opera in Beijing. We can see here receipts from ticket sales. Before it was open, a little over 500,000 renminbi. After it was open, almost 2 million renminbi. Stark change. At the Liyuan and its competitors, the plays they perform for tourists can be and have been called tourist Peking opera, Liu Yo Jinju. And part of the handout explains what I mean by tourist Peking opera. Short performances, short excerpts on the performances. They try and do subtitles and summaries. Lots of martial plays, a lot of Monkey King plays. The very first thing that I showed you had a picture of Monkey King on it. Limited repertory, no name actors, no programs. They're not careful to distinguish what kind of opera you're watching. only spotty advertisements in local media because they don't expect the locals to come. The programs can be changed very quickly. I went to one performance and found that they were having a reception for a bank. And so the performance was actually put off a half an hour until they finished the reception. Audience invited to have photos taken, and these photo ops can take priority sometimes over performance. You can buy souvenirs and gewgaws, and the venues are made up to look like old tea houses. So why should I care about tourist opera? One problem is it's one of the only things you can see nowadays in Beijing. Every summer for the last couple of years, I've been going on CCS money to go hang out with Peking opera people. And I've had many conversations with people who are involved with the presentation of Peking operas for Westerners. These people tend to be former actors who don't act anymore, and they have had little contact with Westerners and generally do not speak English. The thing that I say over and over to them is please don't underestimate the ability of Westerners to relate to Peking opera in one sense or another. And so today I'm kind of betting that you will prove me right and not them right. Okay, and conversely, we'll see how that works. Okay, personally I believe that any reasonably perceptive person, regardless of cultural background, will be moved by performances rooted in a traditional performance system if those performances are done honestly and with all the performer's heart and skill. Conversely, you have the opposite effect. If you have the same perceptive person, regardless of cultural background, I feel that person can feel when he's being condescended to and when the performers are performing with a certain amount of cynicism and bad faith. There are two main models for tourist opera, the Vegas model and the retro model. Okay? We'll begin with the Vegas model. The Vegas model offers a glitzy, new-improved Peking opera supposedly attractive to foreigners. Chinese viewers of these plays are often quite doubtful whether they can be called Peking opera. The Vegas plays tone down elements of Peking opera thought to be not congenial to Westerners, emphasize elements thought to be congenial to Westerners, and add elements from Chinese performance at large because they think that Westerners will like to see them. Let's talk about one specific Vegas-type performance I saw in the summer of 1999. Friends warned me away, but I had to go because I took CCS money because I was going to see exactly what was being performed for this entire month. So I had to go. So it happens I ran into two friends and colleagues in the lobby, Peter Hook and Xinxin Liang. Xinxin might be here. Xinxin's over in the corner. Okay. Xinxin was taking her Chinese language class to see the play. She, Peter, and the students were rather disappointed by what they saw. Xinxin asked me to come over and talk to the students about what they saw and what they might have seen. This is from the program for this particular play. The theater was not the Li Yuan, which I just introduced, but a more recent competitor, the Chang'an Daxian, the Chang'an Great Theater, which is over near the diplomatic section and what has now become the international business section of town in Beijing. The story that was performed was the story of the white snake, who after spending 1,000 years in cultivation turns herself into a woman. So there's not too many of those snakes around, but they have to put 1,000 years in to be able to do it. The romance between the snake and a young man who works in the herbal pharmaceutical trade. His name is Xu Xian. Okay. The story has been portrayed on the Chinese stage for hundreds of years. But the classical form of the story that most people know in China actually only dates to a little after liberation in 1949 and was written by a modern dramatist named Tian Han. Okay, the new version of the White Snake, which we saw in 1999, was carefully designed to meet a specific audience, foreign tourists. The theater and the opera school which performed it are said to have made a massive survey of the tourist market and consulted tourism experts as the production was developed. The play was and is described as tourist Peking opera, Liu Yo Jingju. In 1997, on the occasion of the 100th performance of the new play, they held a symposium to which they invited Peking opera fans, or Ximi, foreign students, and tourism experts. One of the avowed purposes of the symposium was to think about ways to revise the play to be even more attractive to foreigners. The creators of the play expressed the hope that their play could embody the beauty of Peking opera, which they thought that otherwise foreigners could not appreciate, and become the model for this new style of tourist Peking opera. So what did they get rid of, and what did they add in comparison to the ordinary or classical version of the play? The additions are more easily addressed. We divided into two different categories. One is additions concerned with modern Western stagecraft or gimmicks, and the second is elements of traditional Chinese culture. This is another illustration from the brochure. The production claimed that they made full use of the advanced and modern stage facilities at the theater, employing to the full scientific light and sound effects. These included lots of dry ice, which you can see some of right here. And there was a moving sidewalk in the very middle of the stage, right? And also an exploding pagoda. The story of the white snake is that at one point she's stuck under a pagoda. So that's the Vegas part. You could say that they were imitating also big budget Broadway productions such as Cats. Imitating Vegas doesn't sound like a good idea in general, because it will be recognized as an imitation, and an inferior one at that. If that's what Westerners really want, why go all the way to Beijing? Go to Vegas or New York, right? Also, big sets and intrusive stage mechanics interfere with the natural rhythms of Peking opera, which flourished on a bare stage. You have the same problem with Shakespeare. I really dislike the BBC series that they did of the entire plays because they use naturalistic sets. And those naturalistic sets get in the way of the way the plays were originally constructed. The other class of additions included elements from Chinese performance traditions at large. In the words of a newspaper article, the new play incorporated ethnic Chinese acrobatics, song and dance, and other types of performance. Little chart. Peking opera, by its very nature, is a very synthetic and comprehensive style of performance. This chart shows you some of the input that go into drama. Puppetry, dance, farce, storytelling, minstrelsy, shadow plays, and so on. In the West, you have opera for dramatic singing, ballet for dance, mime for pantomime, musicals for song and dance, circus for acrobatics, but in Peking opera, you can have it all going on in the same production. But when these things are used, usually they're used for how they contribute to the whole effect of the play. They are integral and not window dressing. Let me describe one scene in the new White Snake play. This is a scene with no parallel in any form of the story that I'm aware of. And she's a very pretty snake, is she not? Anyway, after the two get married and do a dance with a long strip of red synthetic fabric, which you can see in this illustration, White Snake and Xu Xian go and sit down in the front row of the auditorium so they can watch what's going to happen on stage. And what happens on stage is an enactment of this kind of business. They watch a series of temple fair type performances. What I show you here is a print from the early 19th century depicting such activities. Prominent in the display for the newlyweds is stilt walking, a martial arts demonstration by someone dressed up as a monkey king. So they managed to get the monkey king in, even though there's no plot content, right? And you remember the monkey king from the first transparency I showed you, and here he is again. And we will mention the monkey king again before we're done. And here you can see from the program for the play, dancing on stilts. There was also top spinning with a rope, so you spin them up in the air and catch them, right? And Chinese style rope jumping, but no dialogue and no singing during that scene. This is kind of one-stop shopping for foreigners. You want to see cultural performance? You can see it all at once, right? You can see quaint ethnic Chinese performances that are non-threatening, because there's no dialogue, there's no narrative content, no music, and no bombs, right? Pierre talked about the version of the Peony Pavilion put on at Lincoln Center. When Chen Shizhong finally got it on at the Lincoln Center after being blocked the year before by folks in Shanghai, he also used this kind of three-ring circus approach. The emphasis seems to be on distraction, making the time pass. Of course, Chen Shizhong had 20 hours to kill in his production on the Peony Pavilion, so one can probably feel for him better, whereas the people doing the White Snake play only had an hour and change. Finally, under the category of additions, we can also point out that in the new Whitesnake play, there's a tendency to double up or triple up on traditional Peking opera shtick on the model of if one instance is good, two instances is twice as good, and three instances, thrice as good. Right? To mention just one instance of this, there's the boat on dry land shtick in Peking opera. And I'll show you an example from a different play, and you'll see people park their boat. He's throwing kind of an anchor off. That's it. She bounces up and down, pulling the boat in, sways. So that's what I mean by boat on dry land shtick. Incidentally, that's an example of another bad thing going on, which is that play is actually, the actors are lip-syncing and miming to a earlier recording from the 50s. Okay, so in the 1950s, you had very famous actors, but no video. And now we have less famous actors, but video. And so that's one way they put the two together. Okay, so in this play, the White Snake play, you have, at one point, you have three different boats on dry land kind of careening around on stage. Right? So three is better than two or one. You say, we must be about halfway over, right? So what was left out in this White Snake play? Here we get to the famous fear of Peking opera among Westerners. There is, of course, a fear of opera in general. Joan Sutherland has done a set of videos for kids called Who's Afraid of Opera? I don't recommend it. It's not very well done. There's also a story that at Eastern Connecticut State University, they're using Puccini to punish students. This is for admittedly minor infractions, but a group of students were force-fed a taste of Tosca recently. Right. So, what's so scary about Peking opera? Why would some people prefer water torture, or at least claim they would, to having to listen to Peking opera? There's a basic distinction in Peking opera between natural and falsetto voices, between da song or bun song versus jia song or xiao song. Okay, all the old women among female characters use a falsetto voice. Young males use a mixture of falsetto and natural voice. Older men and older women and clowns use natural voice. And the exaggerated painted face roles use an exaggerated natural voice. It's the female falsetto that seems to get Westerners edgy. Well, falsetto is used because up until the Republican period, male and female performers were not allowed to perform on the same public stage. So men produce an artificial female voice. These are not men. Until the Republican period, which begins 1911, the only female actors on the Peking Opera stage were members of all female troops. And this is an example, illustration from the late Qing period. You have the paradox that the women playing female parts at this time and later are imitating male imitations of the female voice. The most famous performers of Peking opera of the past century, both in China and internationally, were female impersonators. The last of these, Zhang Juncho, died fairly recently, and here he is with an unacknowledged disciple. The disciple, Wen Ruhua, is unacknowledged because the PRC frowned on the idea of men playing sexually desirous women You could play ugly women, you could play old women if you're a man, but not beautiful women. The most famous Peking opera performer of all, Mei Lanfang, was also a female impersonator. And here he is selling cigarettes. The younger female impersonator I just showed you also smokes a lot. It's very curious to me. Presumably, the problem of the falsetto of the female characters is not only that it is a falsetto, but that it is a very piercing and powerful falsetto. And we'll see if that description holds, because you're going to get a taste. Here's what you're going to hear. Okay. What you've got is the notes are indicated by numbers. 1 equals do, 2 equals re. And this is a certain style of opera which doesn't have to have a steady beat, so there's no marks for measures. Later on, you'll see marks for measures. Lao Die Die Zai Chao Zhong, Guang Gao Zhe Xian, Che Wei He Tan Fu Gui, Wu Gu Xiu San. So it's very short, right? 4 lines. You'll be all right. And now we'll hear it. Everybody's all right? In this play, she later feigns to be mad. She's not mad yet. Okay. I tried to pick something that you might not like. How'd I do? We'll see. This kind of voice and voice production was originally designed for outside performance on stages like this. So it had to carry well. And it had to keep the attention of an easily distracted audience, right? So one thing about that kind of voice is you have to pay attention. Just as the voices had to carry, so did the music. This is very different from kunqu, in which the main accompanying instrument is the flute. The Lincoln Center Peony Pavilion production was all in kunqu. Kunqu is more of a kind of a chamber drama, soft on the ears. And I think that's one reason why the New Yorkers, ordinary New Yorkers, had no trouble with 20 hours of kunqu, whereas 20 hours straight of Peking opera might have been a problem. The main instrument of the Peking opera is the huqin, right? Or also called the jinghu. And it's a type of fiddle where the bow strings are put in between the strings of the fiddle, so you can't lose your bow. It's very convenient. Here's a sample of the fiddle playing all by itself, which is a rather unusual thing to do, period. Itself, and it's unusual, it's thrown at the end of a tape, because the idea is that some people would like to hear it just the fiddle all by itself. Ordinarily, someone would be singing at precisely when that type of tune would be played. And it's a famous fiddler. His name is Yang Baozhong. When he couldn't sing anymore, he turned to fiddling. You might think that, well, it'd be nice if he tuned it, but anyway. Okay. Equally raucous is the percussion part of the orchestra. In a second, I'll play you a sample. Let me introduce to you the main instruments. You have the ban, or the clapper, held in the hand. And you also have the dampiku, the single-skin drum. These two are controlled by the most important member of the orchestra, the dagulao, or the sugu, the guy who controls the pace of the entire performance. One percussionist. There's a percussionist who plays the dalo, the big gong, one who plays the shaolo, the shao gong, Chao Gong, and then somebody who plays the cymbals here, Qibo, or something, Nabo. And in a sec, I'll play you something that has this instrument as well, the little bells. Now, there are ways to indicate the sounds that these instruments make by selecting certain characters. And the sample I'm going to play you is this particular pattern. The main contrast is between all the percussion instruments at once, the metal ones anyway, tong, and then the actual sample is slightly different. If it was just qi all by itself, then you would just have the cymbals hitting by themselves. Tse, which is actually what the tape is, as opposed to cymbals and the smaller gong. So I'll play you this sample. And what you'll hear first is someone reciting the syllables and then a sample from a play. This idea, of course, is that you just repeat as long as you want. Something real exciting to happen, right? Okay. The new White Snake play handles the problem of the Peking Opera fiddle and what can be the piercing quality of the singing in falsetto by using canned or pre-recorded music in which the fiddle is buried under other instruments, some of them Western. This goes very counter to the tradition in which the fiddle players themselves were stars, and there should be a kind of subtle interplay between the fiddler and the singer. Often they had their own house fiddle players who would go with them and perform with them. Although a naive listener might not be able to catch all the fine points, but I'm sure that he can feel and appreciate the give and take between the singer and the fiddler. Traditionalists have a hard time even with the idea of reading from printed music. They want it to be happening as it happens. And there's a lot that's just not recorded on the printed music anyway. Peking opera also used to be performed by the orchestra right in full sight at the back of the stage, and then later off to the side. Because there's a concern that Westerners don't put their opera orchestras on stage, and from a misguided notion of realism, Peking opera orchestra in recent years has been put off into the wings. So that if you want to even see the first row of the orchestra, you have to sit way over on one side, look across the auditorium to the other side to see the people playing. The New White Snake play did have a live percussion orchestra, as it would be near impossible to do the fight scenes without one, but they were tucked completely out of sight. The New White Snake play used very little falsetto or traditional singing in general. What was used was softened and kept in the lower registers in terms of both pitch and volume. There was a lot of choral singing, which is not very often used in Peking opera. If you remember, I said that young men are traditionally played with a voice that mixes both falsetto and natural voice. In the new White Snake play, Xu Xian, the young man, was played without any falsetto at all, which incidentally is something they also did in the Cultural Revolution. They got rid of people with squeaky voices of men. To let you hear what this type of voice, the Xiaosheng voice, should sound like, I'm going to show you a chunk of video where this actor will come out and introduce himself in a kind of a sing-song recitation. Wei fang jiao rong, qin dao hong tong, an qing yi dan pao, he er de xiang feng. He's been separated from his sweetie. This tape is from Taiwan, not the best quality. The Xiaosheng actor comes out. This is a separate play, it's not the White Snake play. Oi.
That's it.
When he was poor, he knew this woman. And now he's got an official post, and he's come back to the area where this woman is being tried for murder. One thought, very sexy. To return to singing, in The New White Snake, there's very little of it, and also no show-stopping arias in which singing is focused on. This is very unrepresentative of Peking opera, which has three main categories of plays. First one, Changgong plays, ones that really feature singing. Second one, Zuogong plays which feature acting. Third one, Niangong plays which feature recitation, dialogue, and monologue. By far, it's the first of those three, it's the one that emphasizes singing as most important of all three categories. And the majority of plays can be categorized under that heading. Let's think about Peking opera arias a second, maybe longer than a second. There is the Peking opera fiddle. The arias can be divided into two basic musical systems. Originating from different forms of local opera. We have the Shipi and Arhuang. Here you can see the tunings, and you can see that, again, one means something like do. And Shipi is a little higher, a little more piercing, and Arhuang is lower and darker. The aria that I played where Mei Lang Fang was singing is an example of the Shipi system. The New White Snake play avoids all Shipi, right? But even from the other styles available, it doesn't pick any of the very striking ones. And it doesn't show you the variety of arias in Peking opera. So again, Shipi and Arhuang, and these are the aria forms available in each. What I played you for Mei Lang Fang was an example of Sanban under Shipi. Sanban is here. You have the same option on the other side. Basically, the annotation is that there's no ban and no yan. There's no striking of the clapper to mark the first note of the musical measure. There's no subsidiary beats after the first note of the measure, right? So basically, it's meterless, okay? And they also say, interestingly enough, that you don't know, the annotation is really over on this side. Oh, excuse me. I just covered that. In the Sanban, the singer and the fiddler are free to draw out notes according to an understanding between the two of them. Sometimes it sounds like the fiddler is hanging back. Sometimes it sounds like at the same time the singer is moving forward. And this can be anxiety-provoking first time you hear it, but it's also interesting to follow those kind of interactions. In Peking opera, there is always a contrast between the metered arias and the unmetered arias. There's also always a contrast between singing and not singing, unlike grand opera, where often you have the entire thing sung. Within the metered arias, there's a contrast between fast and slow meters. For instance, fast over here, slow over here, that kind of continuum. And between the relationship of the singers singing and the main beat. So let's think about a metered form, Yaoban, which could be translated as the rocking style. And both styles have them, Yaoban. And it has a ban, but you don't have to be restricted by it when you sing. This is really set up for a singer to be thinking about. And they're only bands, they're only beats per measure. Okay? So if I use my voice, imitate a fiddle, this is the way the musical interlude before somebody starts singing would be. Donger, leager, donger, leager, donger, leager, donger, leager, donger, leager, donger, leager. Then you're supposed to start singing. Nobody broke in. Nobody started singing. Okay. So you're not constrained by the beat. The two things are going on at once. Now I'll play you a sample of the Alban. This happens to be a sheep beat, and it comes from the classical version of the White Snake story. If we can call Ken Ham's version that. A little percussion. She has arrived at Hangzhou, and she's talking about how nice it is at Hangzhou. She's arrived. She's come from Homeishan in Sichuan. Basic beat and the way she's singing. And in that case, there's also an aria that's very similar, the Yoshui, or flowing water aria pattern. But here you have the clapper holding back and the voice rushing ahead. What I'm going to play you is the same play as I showed the young man from. And this is Zhang Junqiu, much younger than the last picture I showed you, right? And this is the aria that you will hear. And it's about a woman leaving prison to go have her case investigated. What you'll hear is three different things on this tape. First, you'll have a teacher on the radio saying the words in his natural voice. And then he'll do it in Do Re Mi. And then we'll hear it in Zhang Junqiu. This is an example of a dialect difference. Now we hear it all together. Zhang Junqiu. Faster arias, and very quickly an example of a slower aria in a style that we haven't heard yet, Fan Erhong. Slower, four beats per measure, very long musical introduction, so I have time to talk. Thank you. that would be nice to listen to a lot of. And I'm afraid we don't have the time. As you can see, it took that long to get through three words. Okay. So that's an example of Fan Arhuang. So within Arhuang, there's also the Fan, or upside down. The tuning is reversed from regular Arhuang. Another thing that the white snake does not do is to highlight the differences between the way roll types sing the same arias. And I don't have time to show you an example of, for instance, Lao Sheng, a specialist in older male, mature males anyway, what that would sound like. Okay. But the white snake play clearly does not want to risk the idea of having somebody sing a lot for these foreigners. That's also the case in the retro model, which we'll turn to now. Like all things retro, the idea is to recover the idea of the past and not its reality. After 49, the PRC did its best to imitate realistic drama, and they started building new theaters with proscenium stages in the Western model. Understandably, you can't expect Western tourists to get too excited going into a theater that looks exactly like the one they left at home. So most of the retro or pseudo-retro theaters, you can find this print on display. It's a late Qing print of a theater. You have a small stage jutting out. In front of the stage, you have benches. Notice that not too many of the people seem to be watching the play. Right? Early theaters were called tea houses, and you paid for the tea, not the play. Folks came and went and enjoyed tea and things to eat. The most expensive seats, though, at this time period, were not down front. This was called the pit, kind of like Shakespeare. The expensive seats were up here in private boxes. I can leave that. Especially as that. You can see some of the orchestra behind the performance. In the retro model, on the other hand, the best seats are the ones right up front. Okay. So the idea is that the tourist is magically transformed back in the Qing Dynasty, and he gets to watch the plays the way they're supposedly watched, although he's more comfortable, and he can bring his flash camera. Some of the retro theaters are restorations of old theaters, such as the Zheng Yisi and the one in the Huguang Native Place Association. This is a picture looking up near the stage out into the audience. The layout of those older theaters is very similar to this, with a stage jutting out and then tables and chairs. This one happens to have benches on either side. Some of them are newly constructed, in which case they will divide, you'll have a modern style stage, and then divide the first floor between tables and chairs and then regular auditorium seating. In both venues, both the retro and the pseudo-retro and the real retro, upstairs is now mostly auditorium-style seating. What kind of plays are performed for tourists in the retro theaters? They show both, in the newer theaters, they show both Vegas plays and traditional plays. The traditional plays are billed as old-style because they want you to think that you're back in old Beijing. What they actually see is a rather selective representatives of Peking opera. As with the Vegas plays, they stay away from plays which feature singing a lot. This is a handout from a talk I gave last year. And in fact, you can find this white snake play right there. There are a lot of monkey plays, particular monkey plays in which they feature pantomime and fighting. A lot of military plays, often in versions which cut out everything but the fighting. There are a lot of fight in the dark plays, such as Sanchako, or the fight at the Crossroads Inn. In that play, the trick is to make you think that it's happening at night, even though the lights are up full. This is the list of plays played at the Liyuan Theater, the first one I introduced in 1993 from the beginning of the year. And we'll see from here that 13 of the 27 dates have that play, Sanchako, which I just mentioned, right? The very first play there is Sanchako. If you add on a similar play to it, Wusong Da Dian, you have over half of the dates have these fight in the dark plays. 17 of the 27 dates feature monkey plays, example of a monkey play, Sun Wukong, and they're always in the last position, the coveted final last play of the night slot. And of the total of 58 plays on this sheet here, 41 of them feature fight scenes. Only One Day deals with one play, the White Snake play, but it's not our Vegas version. The rest of the plays are short ones. To sum up, I want to stress the fact that Westerners are not the first new audience that Peking Opera went after. Okay? There are at least four new audiences that Peking Opera went after. After establishing itself in Beijing in the middle of the 19th century, it tried to spread into Shanghai. There were dialect and cultural obstacles. The Shanghaiese were considered by the Beijingers to be unable to appreciate the subtleties of Peking Opera and only interested in spectacle. A style of Peking opera catering to Shanghai taste, known as Shanghai style or Hai Pai, developed. It stressed the use of mechanical scenery and modern Western stagecraft, and it was performed in big, new Western theaters. And they would even get firefighting equipment up on stage. Right? As Peking opera grew in popularity in Shanghai, theaters there would hire individual stars from Beijing to come down to Shanghai to perform with that theater's house orchestra and house troupe. Mei Lanfang was one of these Beijing actors who would come down to Shanghai periodically to perform. As you remember, mixed gender opera troupes were outlawed until the Republic was founded in 1911. Also, up until that time, mixed gender audiences were prohibited, although with more or less success. Less success in Shanghai because of the foreign concessions in which some of the theaters were located. In Peking Opera's infancy, sex on the stage and male prostitution of the actors off of it was all the rage. Peking opera gradually distanced itself from such and compared to the predominance of young female impersonators at the very beginning of the tradition, gradually moved throughout the 19th century to a dominance by Laosheng actors, who were actors who specialized in mature males who were moral or dignified. There was an interest in the 19th century on political and historical themes. The rise of female impersonators in importance in this century in Peking opera is almost universally linked to the rise of the female audience. Mei Lanfang, who was influenced by what he saw in Shanghai, once said, "When women first started going to see plays, they were naturally rather unsophisticated, or waihang, and what they came to see was spectacle, run out. They went to see what was beautiful to look at, qiaoliang, and didn't care for ugly old men like Tan Xinpei, the most famous Laosheng actor of the day. So the Dan actors, or female impersonators, were what they loved to see perform." This switch from Laosheng to Dan has been characterized by some as a moving away from listening to opera, ting xi, to watching opera, kan xi. Both these audiences, Shanghaiese and women, were won over, although with the result that Peking opera changed in certain ways. Today, the audience for Peking opera is not reproducing itself. The average age of the people who go to see regular performances is older and older, and young fans are hard to find. The government and many scholars declare that new audiences have to be found among the young. How to do that? One scholar has a proposal. He has coordinated the ages of man with different types of plays a person should see. Part of the problem is that the Cultural Revolution and other factors have lowered the level of understanding in the populace about traditional arts in general and history in particular. According to this one scholar I mentioned, such young people are easy prey for vulgar pop songs from Hong Kong. Someone did a survey and found out among 100 students that only 3 of them knew who Mei Lanfang was, whereas 76 knew the pop star Mei Yanfang. Anyway, what kind of play should kids be first taken to see, according to the scholar? First you take them to go see Monkey King plays. Then you take them to see military plays. Then you can take them to see plays which emphasize dialogue, and then ones that emphasize singing, and then finally full-scale plays, which use all the resources of Peking opera. What do old folks want to go see? Plays that deal with problems, or which are philosophical. Okay, it remains to be seen whether Peking opera can win over today's youth. But what about Westerners? Are we doomed to be forever taken as kindergartners and offered Monkey King plays to watch? The tourist opera venues in Beijing today seem to be content with one-time customers. I hope I've been able to persuade you today not to be satisfied with what they're selling in Beijing now as Peking opera and to demand more. I'll stop there. have precious little time for questions, but we have a little bit of time, and I'm willing to stay longer, of course. Yes, in the back.
Can you give any comments about the speed versus the Western operation?
The pace?
Yes, you can say. You know, Peking opera can never go faster than rock and roll than any of the rest of the world. They do the audience. The younger ones in China, they don't like it. The American generation Y definitely cannot see this. You know, see this. 3 minutes, one word.
Things can go extremely quickly on the Peking Opera stage, and they can go extremely slowly. Actually, as a foreigner first watching Peking Opera, I liked when they went slow, because I can keep up with the subtitles just fine. But there is that contrast there. But in general, the pacing is slow. Why? Because the focus is on the expression of emotion, and you have to have a certain amount of, you build up to that expression of emotion. But the things that people remember about plays are the outpouring and overgushing of all this emotion, which takes time for it to flow all over the place. And so it is a kind of a slow-paced and general orientation. And they used to be, the performance was extremely long, sometimes 6-7 hours. And this is for people who have time on their hands, right? They're not coming from the office.
You mentioned about
the
tea house.
Mm-hmm.
Keeping up doors. Tea house, they're doing nothing, just, you know, eating.
And not necessarily pay attention.
In America, you have a coffee house, but those youngsters, they're doing the homework and work on their laptop. They definitely will not listen to Peking Opera, which is too slow. Do you think that will doom that Peking Opera will become history?
Well, one thing is that things changed when Peking Opera was put into new style theaters. Right? The performance, the way people reacted to performance was different. And so they would pay attention when they wanted to and talk with their friends. I showed you pictures of one of the restored theaters. Upstairs, actually, the most expensive places, the little private rooms, you can't see this stage with a hoop. And so it's clearly that this was a social place where people would go. They could hear the music they want. If somebody decided to go, they could come out of the little room and go to the railing and watch what was going on stage. But a very different relationship. What happened in the PRC is that they wanted to imitate the Soviets, for instance, and you sit in a regular theater, sit in cushiony chairs, and you sit there and you're quiet. Right, which is very different from how you used to clap. So it's very different a performance style and appreciation style. Yes?
Yeah, I guess maybe one concern would be the content of the opera. Like recently, they rewritten an old opera to address the issue of injustice and the corruption in the government. And it attracted a lot of audience, young and the old, everybody interested in seeing it. So I guess it's because the old stories are too far away from contemporary audience, and the old story has nothing to do with contemporary life. Why should people go to see it? If it matches, I mean, the old story or even new story match contemporary people's concern or their interest, then that would change the population of visitors.
There was a tradition for the clown actors to make topical remarks. So they could bring in politics, but it was done in such a way that you couldn't be caught, right? Because it wasn't in the script, right? And it would be in an intimate setting in the middle of the play, and it would be unexpected. But in general, there wasn't a lot of political satire in this style. Because the people, even those clowns that made those remarks, many of them were thrown in jail. So there was heavy surveillance of opera. Because there was this idea, this was the mass media. And there were people on the one side who actually wrote plays to attack the typing rebels and things like that. You got government support. And on the other hand, people who thought that plays were dangerous if they weren't controlled. So it was very sensitive what was put on the stage, and to monitor very carefully.
Yeah, it seems to me that there's two separate issues here. One is the issue of appealing to a current generation of the Chinese audience, and mm-hmm. the other is the tourist mm-hmm. performances. It seems to me that Peking Opera may be doomed in terms of the indigenous audience. It may have its time may be over. And of course this happens to art forms all the time.
Mm-hmm.
They become out of sync.
Mm-hmm. Museumified.
Yeah. The tourist performance is another issue, and I agree with you that they don't have to be so bad. People are doing this all over the world, as you know. They're
mm-hmm.
they're redesigning their indigenous forms to present to an audience which doesn't know the tradition and doesn't know the language and doesn't know any of the subtleties. They can't tell a good performer from a bad. So inevitably, the tourist performances, there's always a diminution of subtlety, always.
And it's extremely hard to play to such an audience. They don't know what you're doing.
It is hard, but it doesn't seem to me that you have to go as far as they currently have gone here. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is really quite extreme in terms of making a form appeal to some sort of very low common denominator. Now, I suspect that the tourist audiences in some way, I think this is generational. For instance, when I first started teaching world music here a long time ago, picking opera was the hardest thing in the world to teach. The students would act. And those are the people that are now the tourists in China. And they're still going, however, students now, it's an entirely different situation. First of all, they've all grown up on nonsuch records. Mm-hmm. And they're sophisticated in a way that generation of now tourists never was. Right. And they're fascinated by difference. They're not turned off by it in the same way. So it seems to me it's time that somebody ought to tell the people that are dealing with the tourist performances that times are changing and they don't need to do this. And mm-hmm. It seems to me you'd be a wonderful person to do that.
Most of the last two summers, too.
You did.
I think that I agree with that. And, I mean, having seen White Snake, I think that most of the students who went to see it with tended to see right through kind of the facade of tourist shit. And I think that a lot of them saw it be somewhat plastic. And it may also be true that those same students just may not be able to get into the more kind of hardcore traditional versions of the opera. But I think that certainly there can be a toned-down middle ground it's not as plastic, and there are a good bit of, kind of nuances and sophistication, but that there isn't kind of but maybe excluding some of the things that simply are going to die out anyway. But I think that as long as the more terse, the extremely plastic kind of boxed version of Peking opera keeps on putting out, I think that a lot of the tourists really see through it and are going to maybe that version.
I think there's also a quality and attitude issue, because the senior people won't touch this stuff, right? So you never see a good actor on stage doing it. And there's a certain amount of cynicism that comes in, because if they do what they're supposed to do, then they don't necessarily get the right reaction out of the audience. There's no reinforcement from that. And so you see a lot of sloppy stuff going on. So even the elements that they are using in tourist opera are generally not done very well. And so I think there's a general devolution.
We should remember, I mean, I'm not well educated in this, but 30 years ago when I was here, Professor Joan, who drew large crowds for his annual demonstrations.
Right. And I hear he sings in classes sometimes as
well. No, he did.
Professor Zhang Chunshu.
So,
yes.
David, why can't there be the introduction for the tourists of short sections of the traditional opera and you explain exactly what's going on there? And just do it the old way. Sure, they would act. They don't need Las Vegas type stuff. It's terrible. And that's a problem all through China. And I've just been there and seeing the way they handle the visual arts is the same sort of thing. I mean, they throw junk at people. But you throw the real thing, but it can be explained enough so that the traditional way is preserved and the meaning gets through to a relatively educated audience which is coming as tourists to China.
Right, so even somebody like Ravi Shankar will often give a kind of a lecture demonstration before the real performance.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you're interested, you can take part in that. The amount of people who can handle English and Peking opera in Beijing is very slim. And you can see that immediately when you pick up the stuff that's written in English. And so they did have one place they would have announcement in English. You couldn't understand the person because they're using bad sound systems, bad English, and so forth. And so they need work.
Yeah, but if the politicians who are running the tourist industry now, it's very clear, put money into it and paid the good guys plenty of money, why not do that instead of, into building roads and high buildings and all this stuff because they want to attract the tourists. Well, if they can be convinced that you attract good tourists and it'll pay, and then you give them lots of money, you see.
Right.
So I don't know, that's becomes a political matter in that sense.
Can I just respond to the gentleman's question also, but the picking up from more towards romantically extreme in, you know, white snake stories and whatever, show their feelings through the long voices of the melody. Westerners probably more towards immediately get a satisfaction understanding the solution rather than the original problem in philosophy. There are different, you never complete the Westerners by picking up on what I believe. I love it very much, but I believe that we'll never get a market. Westerners is harmonically extreme to that some degree, like Romeo and Juliet, even to more and more now Prince have a new version of Romeo and Juliet. And the Eastern ways is romantically extreme to the degree that even the falling one is a snake and willing to die with, you know, for the lovers. There's no future for picking up. I think this is definitely going to become the history. Right. Unless they completely changed by Mao's wife, he did it. Right. But what is the result?
There are similarities, of course, with Western opera. Many of the Western opera stories are as silly as you get. Many of the picking opera stories are as silly as you get. You know, people talk about that Western opera is doomed, right? William Bocom here, who writes opera, was interviewed and said he doesn't see much future for the form. And so, there's the same kind of problem here with Western opera. One is this gushing out of emotion that some people have a lot of trouble with. Yes,
I don't have
this
fatalistic view of things, but I'm not, I don't have the same expertise, but I've seen really interesting ways that opera is used in spoken drama and in experiments with Western-style drama in China. And I definitely noticed in the later 90s with the whole resurgence of nationalism in China that this, the kind of reaching out to the West that preceded it is now being answered even by young people who feel their own culture slipping away and want to find ways to hold on to it. And so, I mean, it pops up in all kinds of different ways, and most ways that I'm sure you would consider pure, but in ways that are very appealing. And these shows are extremely, I mean, one of the most successful plays and best plays I've seen in China was a Hua Ju version of White Snake that won all kinds of awards. And there's been experimental versions. And then, you know, this play Birdman that was a huge smash hit in Beijing and revived theater about 5 years ago, 7 years ago now. You know, one of the big appeals of it was this whole Peking opera thing running through the play, and in the third act, they play out scenes from traditional opera, and the crowd was just cheering. So I do think that deep down in the national psyche, Peking opera has a very special place. Now, whether that means young people will flock to the theater, of course, is another matter. But I don't think it'll ever die, and I do think that there's efforts to preserve it. And I was going to mention just a quirky thing that I came across was karaoke Jingju videos and stuff. And I use these when I try to teach students about opera.
Everything but the singer, and you can sing at home.
Or it's got like Mei Shao Wu, Mei Lanfang's son has this tape out, and the Susan aria, you know, he does it first with the words and the music, and then they just show him mouthing it, and you're supposed to sing along, or you do it with them. I mean, that's one way that it's kind of cheesy to us, but the karaoke thing was a very, not Western, I mean, it came from Japan, but it was a very modernist kind of craze, and I think opera is looking for ways to stay with it. But one thing I think is underlying all of this, especially when we're critiquing the ways that it's marketed for Westerners, is this question of what is Western, what is the Western aesthetic? And I think that many artists in China have a different idea of what is Western than the actual tourist sitting there. And that, to me, seems to be at the base of a lot of this, and it's the kind of dialogue you're suggesting that's going to help the two come together. But there is this very strong idea of what Westerners like, and it is a little off, but it comes from somewhere. And I think the really interesting question is, where do these conceptions come from, and how are they perpetuated? What is it when Chinese pop culture meets Western pop culture, that, or when Chinese traditional culture meets Western pop culture? What's this transmission process that's producing this idea of what is Western? Mm. To me, that's a very intriguing question.
Mm. You notice at the end I compared what they want kids to be in watching and what they're presently showing Westerners. And basically infantilizing Westerners.
Yeah, I think it's based, on a false idea that East and West are different. Mm-hmm. They have different approaches to things, but there are lots of things that are the same.
Right.
And those things, I mean, you could
they're the same. Yeah, Western want to eat the cake, and Eastern want to have the cake. They want to put it in the mouth, they don't swallow. And Eastern, even digest, they already go into stomach.
We do like to eat cake.
It just never be the same.
You cannot claim the Westerner, all the Westerners out here, they know what they're doing. You don't have to label them, you Westerners, you don't understand Chinese. This is not the way it goes, and a lot of educated Westerners do understand Chinese, sometimes to a degree. Chinese do not understand themselves. So people do have different perspective, but don't just say you are low and you cannot understand Chinese. It's not the way it goes, and everybody is equal. I agree with Dick about this. People do share feigning. Like David pointed out, when the Peking Opera singing a sad song, people do feel that sometimes. So you can't say, okay, you guys don't understand, let me play a monkey for you. Well, that's for common visitors sometimes, like someone not that well educated, probably there is a problem, just like an undereducated Chinese could not appreciate the high culture there. So it's the same problem like we face in the West, not a garbage collector or somebody could appreciate Shakespeare. This is the same problem we face, the challenge, and it's not a moment to blame somebody, you don't understand, you're an outsider, come on. I guess it's a way to think about it, and then to figure out ways how people can communicate and understand each other.
David, how did the ignorant tourists in the hotel setting react to the play? I mean, did you feel like the basic tourist base enjoys these performances, or no?
They're not following the plays very closely, and they're not. They react very differently from the way the plays posit the audience. So they have trouble fitting into the implied audience of the plays.
Okay.
But there could be an education process, but that's not happening now because it's a revolving door. You go and you see it once, and you've seen the Peking Opera, and that's enough.
Yeah.
In fact, before
you
go that night,
Beijing,
you don't know what
you're
seeing.
See that, yeah.
There's no advanced program. There's no advanced notice of what plays are actually performed. There's nothing that you get in the theater that tells you who played what. Or even the Leon Theater sells a book which has 30 plots of summaries in it. No names of actors at all. And so you're supposed to figure out that night which one is being played. Yes, Rob.
I'm wondering if these theaters or the Chinese tourist authorities differentiate between what you were calling as Western tourists and Japanese, Korean, Taiwanese, Hong Kong tourists, which I assume are still a large portion of the tourist market.
The main thing that's considered a Western is an English speaker. And there's general expectation that Japanese will go or be led to more regular performances, but the problem is that there aren't the regular performances to see now. So if you go to Beijing, one of the things is, go to Beijing, what do you gotta do? You gotta see Peking Opera. And it's the only tourist opera to see. So you go see the Monkey King. You say, well, I went to the Peking Opera. So it's not in great shape. But they're really thinking of English language audience. People who can handle English at least reading as opposed to speaking. Europeans, Americans, whatever. Yes?
I think the only way to appreciate Peking Opera and understand Peking Opera is to watch it and listen to it over and over.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only way. From my experience and from the Pusan, a lot of Chinese band.
Mm-hmm.
And so.
And we're talking about native speakers of Chinese here. Right. So it's difficult even for native speakers of Chinese to follow what's happening on the stage. Because there are certain distortions that take place in the language. Chinese is a tonal language. Once you start singing it, things change. Even regular dialogue is stylized.
And I don't think we can fall in love with Peking Opera at first sight.
Mm-hmm. The old model was that your parents would go take you to the opera, right? And they'd be right there and they'd tell you what you're watching. Well, I remember going in the 1980s and listening to Chinese who had brought foreigners to watch a play, and they're telling the most absurd things about what's going on stage to the foreigners. They have no idea what's going on. But, there's a gap in knowledge about the traditional stuff. Yes.
What about the situation in Taiwan?
Taiwan is very different, more conservative. They've tried to keep the stages and staging much more traditional, so they use popping, for instance. But again, there's no audience. There used to be five troupes, there's only two now. It used to be there were performances every night. I don't think that's the case anymore. I first started watching Peking Opera in Taiwan, and I worked in the opera school there, and I thought it was great, but when I got to the mainland, I realized, you know, how poor quality we're dealing with these people, because it's a very limited resource of audience. You have the mainlanders who came over, who bought Beijing Opera with them. In Taiwan, the opera was always associated with the military. In fact, the four of the troops were basically subsidized by the military. And now that, you know, the people have grown up, who lived, were born there, right, and don't have the association with the mainland, there's not that much. There's not the steady kind of audience. You have the, you know, the same aging of audience in there. And it's predominantly a male audience in Taiwan. I'm a little more mixed.
And we evaluate the mouse-wide work
She studied Peking Opera.
I know, but is it better, helps a little give rebirth of Peking Opera?
I'm not particularly agree with her. What happened in the Cultural Revolution, that you had the same eight plays played over and over again, and you were saturated in them from all different media. So on the one hand, people, I think, had an opposite reaction. They didn't, didn't want to hear this stuff again. I met one guy who was forced to play piano accompaniment for these kind of plays for several years, and then was forced to do very hard labor, and he said he enjoyed the hard labor. but for other people, it's in there. The tracks from Beijing Opera are in there, and it just takes a little touch and an immediate recognition. All forms of local opera in Beijing are very closely associated to place. Beijing Opera has become a national form, but it's still strongly associated with Beijing. When Chen Gaige put so much of the Peking Opera stuff in Farewell My Concubine, one of the things he said, I wanted the sound of old Beijing. And this is what people associate and mention about. Now they're talking locally about Peking Opera as being a old slay, you know, the national essence of Chinese culture. They didn't do that so much, especially during Zhang Qing's time. It's part of being Chinese, having some kind of relationship to a local opera, like your own local opera, or to Peking Opera, or to Kunqun. You're not cultured, you can at least say something about it, right? Especially when you're foreign fencing. Any more questions? Yes?
Just a thing to toss out. We used to think beauty was in the eye of the beholder, but it seems like recent research has shown that beauty is sort of universal. That, as we contrast, there's sort of something that it goes toward. I got to thinking about that after watching Les Mis and how every different nationality seemed to get the goosebumps and enjoy the particular moments. And I thought that was amazing that all over the world they could be enjoying something like that. Maybe just some pieces of pie are more, or cake.
Are more sellable?
Are more sellable, yeah, more universal.
Well, that's partly because Western culture has spread so far. Whereas Peking Opera is only spread, and more now, with films like Farewell, My Concubine. People are getting more and more exposure to those kind of things. So I think people have, like Judith said, people have far greater tolerance for unusual styles of music than they once had. Any other questions? Thank you.